And you are listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea, K284AL, Haleiwa, which plays really around most of Oahu now, at least 400,000 of you. So we're really happy to have you in our listening audience. And Dana Lyons off his new album, The Great Salish Sea. And then that song is It's a Matter of Asking, which he wrote on Molokai. And so he's really theming into some of the ideas that we'll be speaking about today. I'm Felicia. This is Kauai Soapbox. And this program is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with Kauai Canvas.
Kauai Canvas, professional gallery quality giclée canvas printing and digital image capture now available on Kauai. Managing print flow, stretching, and even crating. More information at 212-6971 or online at kauaicanvas.com. Kauai Canvas, stretch your imagination.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of KKCR, its board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
For supporting Kauai Community Radio, the station that loves you. So this is Felicia. I'm really excited about today's show. It's another one that really looks about building the resilience of Kauai. We want a resilient Kauai. And we've got two great guests here today. One is Chief Prosecutor Justin Caller.
Aloha. Good afternoon, Felicia.
Good afternoon. I'm glad that you are here. And we also have Sai Shim in, who was here last week discussing different elements about both Hawaiian nationhood, the Hokulea, and then most importantly for this show, what it was the experience of spending time in jail recently.
Hi, Felicia.
Hi. So, we are, pretty soon I'm going to be making a few announcements for different people that I'll make them right now. There are two important meetings coming up this evening. One is at 5 o'clock, and that is for Hawaiian nationhood at Anahola. It's dealing with Oha and Aha. It's happening at the Anahola Clubhouse. It seems rather important. So if you've got the cocoa, show up. Anahola Clubhouse, 5 p.m. And then the other one is at 5:30 p.m. in Camp Naui in Hyena. There are people there that are concerned about the cell tower proposal. And so a number of the community members are meeting at Camp Naui to talk about that. So both of those events are coming up. We have a third guest who's going to be a call-in guest because he is going to the meeting in Anahola, but that is Keo Kauihana, who has been on a show earlier, and he has particular interests relative to being a Hawaiian national and complying with the law. That seems to be a challenge, and we'll be expecting a call from him in about 15 minutes. So in framing the discussion, I'm really excited to have both of you in here because from my perspective, it seems like we have an awful lot of adjudicated people and incarcerated people. And when I see that how high the numbers are, it seems almost like an indictment of the system. And I want to talk about how to keep people out of jail in the first place, understanding what brings them there, and how do we shorten the process. So when people do make mistakes, that it's get in, get out, get over it. And when there is a situation of a dangerous criminal, well, then they really need to be in there. Justin, would you like to start with some thoughts? I will have both of you basically introduce yourselves to the topic.
Sure, Felicia. And again, just thank you for asking me to come up and participate in today's program. I think this is the fourth or fifth time I've been up here, and every time it is an educational and informative experience for me, and a good opportunity to come up and have a dialogue with the community. And also happy to meet Sai here in the studio today as well and hear about his experiences. Incarceration, as we approach it in the criminal justice system, is really intended to be the option of last resort in terms of what we look for to protect the community. Generally speaking, for somebody to be looking at a significant period of incarceration, it's generally not their first time or their first involvement in the criminal justice system. It costs an awful lot of money to lock somebody up, about $50,000 a year for an adult to house them in our correctional system. And when you start to talk about juveniles, it actually costs around $200,000 a year to keep a juvenile incarcerated at the youth correctional facility on Oahu. So, you know, we're sensitive not only to the cost to the taxpayers, but the cost to the community in terms of, you know, family life interruption, trauma to others involved, the likelihood of future success for the offender who's being put into that system. You know, and we really try to be as thoughtful and, you know, judicious as possible when we go into court asking for prison time in a particular situation. So, you know, like you said, there are clearly folks out there that, you know, prison is the only safe alternative for the community. And we, you know, as prosecutors, we don't take any joy in sending somebody to prison. It's something that we, in our judgment, you know, are doing to protect the community from somebody who has created a dangerous situation for themselves or for their family or for their community or for anyone out there. So those are a couple of the you know, factors that highlight our approach. You know, under the Hawaii Revised Statutes, a sentencing judge is required to look at a whole host of different factors when imposing their sentences. And folks who have been around here on Kauai for a while are no doubt aware that different judges look at those sentencing criteria in different ways. Some of them are favorable to follow recommendations made by a prosecutor, others more inclined to follow their own way within their discretion. So it's a fluid continuum, and it's something that we try to be aware of and plan for the best we can, but always, you know, with the idea of keeping the community safe. Not to, you know, monopolize all the conversation here, but I do want to point out that, you know, one of the reasons I'm proud to be a prosecutor is because we're the only attorneys who, when we get up in the morning each day, our job, our mission is to go out and do the right thing. You know, we don't have to worry about billable hours. We don't have to worry about protecting our clients' money. You know, it's our job to get up and do the right thing at the right time for the right reason to the right person, and to do it with the goal of seeking justice. So, you know, as long as we keep that mission statement in the forefront of what we do, and I do my best to instill that upon my staff each and every day, we should end up with just results for the community. So thanks for having me come up and be on.
You're welcome. And I'm happy that you mentioned that it affects other people, because it's generations that are impacted when somebody is adjudicated. And when I use that word, I mean when they're going to court, all that sorts of things. It's grandma, it's their children, it's whoever is helping fund the whole process. So, yes, it is about more than the accused.
That's right. And, you know, Maka'ala came and was sitting in my office. We were having a conversation last week, and she was talking about the old days when we had the courthouse in Hanalei, we had the courthouse in Koloa, we had the courthouse in Waimea. And, you know, if somebody that she was one of her extended Ohana members had got themselves in trouble and had to go down in front of the court, in front of Judge Frank or somebody else down there, you know, she could go down and kind of let them know, oh, I got my eye on this one. you know, and make that family connection so that the judge would understand that kind of family dynamic, that there was somebody in the community out there that was going to be able to kind of keep an eagle eye over that particular individual. These days, you know, we have one courthouse. It's in Lihue. For folks who live up here on the North Shore or folks who live way out on the West Side, it does take time to get there. You know, we're dealing with, you know, in a lot of cases, folks who have to rely on public transportation or catching a ride as catch can from a friend, uncle, or just hitchhiking. So, you know, it does disrupt the family just in terms of the sheer amount of time that folks have to take to come up and be in court, also involving taking time just out of work to be able to come to court. And, you know, in the event that there is incarceration, you know, the time away from the person's job as well as time away from the person's family. So those are all things that we try to make sure we're aware of. And, you know, the court certainly, you know, I've seen judges go to great lengths to craft sentencing alternatives or sentencing options for folks based on, you know, preserving that family time or preserving, you know, a person's ability to work, you know, within the realm of reasonableness. So, yeah, I understand how it can be quite difficult.
Si?
Well, first off, thanks for being here, Justin. I really do appreciate being able to be here with you. And just from what you just said, I and what Felicia was talking about, you know, how generations are affected, it was something that's always talked about in the jail while I was there, is the generational curse. How, you know, while I was there, there was a mother, a father, and a son in there. And then you have many fathers and sons in there, and people that have been there for 30, 35 years in and out of jail. And I'm glad you said your mission statement. I really, for the first time, actually, when I was incarcerated, I really did get a sense that how much there is this behind the scenes working together with the prosecutors as well as the public defender's office and the jails, that the warden is actually, you know, writing stuff up and taking notice. So everything you're doing, everything we're doing as an inmate at the time, everything I was doing in the jail makes a difference. And it's either noticed on a good point or it's noticed on a bad point. And it was really refreshing for me to know that, to really see it firsthand, like, oh yeah, wow. You know, the prosecutors aren't there to just nail us and you know, put us in, all in jail. I think there's a lot more that can be done, and you know, I don't know exactly what they're exactly what to do or what's going to work, or I think it's a work in progress, and it'll come out of our communication and in the conversation of working together. One thing that happened this morning as I was watching the news was about Boston, which is where Justin's from, right?
And spent 16 years there, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, about the Boston bombing, and one of the things that was real clear was that when the FBI came in, there was all this information that was withheld, so there's no working as a group of guys to solve this thing. It was it can be really frustrating. And I saw that for the first time, that, wow, there's really, even with the judges, that there's a lot of communication that goes on, and I gained a lot more respect for all you guys that are in the, you know, I mean, I had a lot of respect for the warden. The warden sits in it every day, and he wakes up to it, goes to sleep in it, and this past Friday, myself and Jimmy Rodella were allowed to go and have a Friday night dinner cookout, and got to be guest speakers, and it was just, as much as we enjoyed being there, we were glad we could go back home after the meeting. You just got to really see, wow, man, these guys are, the warden, all the staff, ACOs, that's your job, to have to go in every day, and including for you too, Justin, that you guys actually wake up, and what you're dealing with is every case that's sitting here in front of us. And so there's that part of me that really has all that respect for that. And I have my family, I don't know if you know, but my family has been very much in the system. My father has been an attorney who passed away in 2006, but who actually wrote the Aloha Spirit Law.
He was part of the whole setup of the state, really, right?
Yeah, he actually...
And your uncle, you're...
My mom's younger brother is Walter Heen, who was a federal judge.
Oh, yeah.
Walter Heen, so he's... And then our granduncle was Robert Puwiki, who was a judge way back in the 1890s. And I have a family that's been in this system for a long time. So the whole overthrow and during the overthrow and annexation and all that illegal actions that had happened, I think what's occurred in it all is that there are a lot of mistakes made, and a lot of things weren't called when they should have been called back in by my own kupunas. And some of the fight that we have today with the Hawaiians versus the whole judicial system is the unfairness and unclarity. And, you know, where, for me, really, while I was in jail, I wouldn't say on the run, but I had a warrant out for me for almost 2 years. I don't know if you remember, but I was one of those guys.
I don't keep track of all the warrants.
I was one of those guys, Justin. But not like I was hiding. I was in the community, putting on concerts, doing all kinds of stuff. But
sure.
It was... It really shifted when I got in jail, realizing that I can't have this warrant, this stuff on me, unless I'm really clear, if I really want to make a move and make a stand for what I feel is right. And that doesn't mean that it is right. It's just my own opinion and what I stand for and what I've seen over the past and what wrongs that I've done and, you know... And there's so much involved. I'm sure that's probably one of your biggest challenges is really, other than any other state that you could have been working in, that you chose Hawaii, which is really in the midst of a kingdom coming back to really how do we dance to all of it all and really respect each other for who each of our opinions have. You know, it's a huge, huge undertaking, and I think we're all moving in the right direction. I think regardless, there's a lot of, with the GMO stuff, and you know, there's a wide range of opinions about everything, but I think that we're keeping the conversations alive, and we're really, there's been a lot of healing and respect for each other's communications along the way, which really makes a huge difference for me.
Yeah, I would agree. I think mutual respect is something that goes a long way, and I always emphasize to my deputies that when they're in court, to treat the person standing at the other table the way that you would want your family member to be treated if they were in that situation, or treat them the way you would want to be treated if you were in that situation. And, you know, you mentioned the multi-generational effects of involvement in the criminal justice system and the way that you do see fathers, grandfathers, sons, nephews, nieces, all, you know, basically doing time together. And, you know, much like the warden, me and my staff, we wake up with this stuff and we go to bed with this stuff. Every time somebody's arrested on the island, the arrest report, basically the booking sheet, gets emailed out to our staff, and so, you know, we wake up in the morning, and one of the first things I do is look through and see what, you know, what the arrest log is. And sometimes you see a name there and you just think to yourself, I thought he said last time was the last time. And, you know, we feel like, you know, even though we're on opposite sides of the criminal justice system, you know, we have that connection in that we know who these people are. We know what the history is. You know, if we're discussing the case in the office, sometimes we'll say, oh, you know, where's the dad at? Or is this the son or is this the father? Which one is this? And the nature of it being such a small island is that we do get a sense of what those connections are and what the impact is when, you know, say a particular member of the family is getting in trouble again, or you know, they've gotten their act together and are staying out of trouble. We do get a good sense of those things. And part of me managing and retaining a good staff is having folks in there who develop an understanding and an awareness for that dynamic, because it makes them better prosecutors for the community.
And I have K.O. Kauihana on the phone with us. And K.O., are you there?
Yes, aloha, Felicia and Justin. How you doing?
Aloha, and speak into your phone as directly as you can. I'm glad that you called in, because you're at a good point where something that I think is very important is a number of these elements that I consider identity, self-identity problems, like crimes, when somebody is Hawaiian national, and even that is breaking the law. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Let me try. A Hawaiian national is someone that has ties to the land. Yeah, and Hawaiian national is someone that has ties to Hawaiian land. And how you would do that is... have tied to the land would be title. Title to the land would be the beginning of the laws that would govern the land. And so with the overthrow, the laws were changed over the land. And now these new laws, which have been brought over here illegally, yeah, we have no treaty, and there's no annexation. So how did the title to the land change the law? How was the law changed, and that the usage of the land is now criminalized when a Hawaiian national is brought into the picture?
Well, help us understand, how is a Hawaiian national criminalized when they are brought into the picture? Like, I'm thinking maybe with the driver's licenses or the license plates?
We go and we formed our government. And our government made laws to create the license plates and driver's license for a Hawaiian national. And that's how it was manifested. Yeah, because the state of Hawaii doesn't recognize the Hawaiian national. I mean, to them, we are manifesting on our own. And they have a hard time accepting it right now. And so that's a good question for the prosecutor there, is that he wants to be fair and have justice, which is his mission statement. And he has to enforce these foreign laws, which are illegally here. I have a hard time convincing me to follow these new laws. Yeah, especially when it alienates me from my land. And see, there's no connection. The state of Hawaii has no connection with the Native Hawaiian, the Hawaiian national. In fact, they won't even recognize them. They're so afraid of losing their authority that they prefer playing politics and getting paid their paychecks than following the rule of law. Here in Hawaii, politics rule and not law.
So do you want Justin to respond to that?
Yes, if he can. I mean, I would appreciate it.
Sure. You know, and thanks for calling in and you know, raising this issue. You know, I'm aware that there's probably very little that I can say that is going to change your mindset, but I do at least want to communicate what my mindset is and what our mindset is when we approach these issues. And, you know, from our perspective, you know, we have folks you know, actually my job is to really divorce as much as possible politics from the goal of keeping the community safe and from, you know, creating a healthier community. So the way that I do that is to make sure I apply the laws as equally as possible to everybody who, for example, operates motor vehicles on the roadway. And we have folks from many nations who are nationals of many different places that come here to Hawaii and operate motor vehicles. And, you know, the upshot of that is that no matter where they're from or whatever their nationality may be, they need to have a driver's license and motor vehicle insurance that is recognized by the state. And the purpose behind that is to ensure that when folks get into accidents where people are injured or property is damaged, that the person has insurance to make right any injury or damages that were done to those folks involved in those crashes, and to keep the peace and welfare in that manner. So, you know, I have absolutely no, you know, my rock solid belief is that every human being is born entitled to self-determination in terms of their politics, in terms of their religion, in terms of their identity, in whatever way they want to define themselves. That's your entitlement as a human being in the universe, and I think we all have that. But if you're going to drive an 8,000-pound piece of metal at high speeds down the roadways of the state, you've got to have some insurance, and you've got to have a license to ensure that, you know, your eyes work and you're familiar with the rules of the road and things of that nature. So, you know, perhaps one day we'll see a situation where the state recognizes different types of driver's licenses than it recognizes today. And when that happens, hey, more power to you.
Well, I have a few thoughts. I mean, it would recognize a California driver's license, right?
There's an interstate compact that exists that recognizes driver's licenses from the 50 states as well as, you know, Marianas Islands, Samoa, places like that, as well as under, you know, certain conditions, various international driver's licenses. Not all international driver's licenses, but many of them. So there's an interstate compact that governs that, and the process to include other licenses within that is a question of modifying that. So.
And this is Felicia Kauai Soapbox, Keo Kauihana on the phone, Justin Collar, Chief Prosecutor, Sai Shim in the studio with me. You're listening to KKCR, Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea. Keo, something that you alerted me to before the show, and I looked it up, which is this Maui law. It's a resolution, which isn't really the same thing as an ordinance, but 1079. And I looked at it, and I think that's something that you and I should take to Jay Fufaro and Mason Chalk as soon as they're done with the budget and see if we can't get a Kauai resolution very similar, because this one, Justin, is something that acknowledges the history of what's happened to the Hawaiian people and acknowledges that it really was an unjust takeover. It goes right through it and the apology elements and all of that, and it says, okay, we're going to honor it. And so, Keo, on Maui, can people drive with their own driver's plates?
Yes. Yes, they're exempt because of that law. They're letting them go. And we already talked to the county here, and we're waiting for the response. To this day, they have not responded back to that.
Okay, well, I will help you look at that, and we should research for a fact that, like, it might be that they are looking the other way, or if it is really a reality that they do accept that. Because it seems like there should be a way to have this duality here. Justin,
and, you know, Felicia, yes? When you read about the indigenous rights, yeah, that Obama just recently signed. In fact, he signed it right after that ordinance was passed. 10 days after that ordinance was passed, he was now allowed to sign that because now they were in compliance with the indigenous rights of the native people. Finally, the Indians, they are not in compliance with. So now the Hawaiians, Now they're getting their recognition here. Allowed Obama the right to sign that indigenous from the United Nations. Because of what the Hawaiians did of seeking recognition. Because he couldn't do it with the Indians. I mean, he had bad history with the Indians. Yeah? But he couldn't sign that with the Indians.
Sai?
How's it, Kale? This is Sai.
Aloha.
I don't know if I've ever met you or you've met me, but and I don't know if you heard earlier my family and how I have my family has a history of being judges and in the system. My father was actually wrote the Aloha Spirit Law and also was in the system for a long time, hired Governor Waihe'e right out of his college, Mazie Hirono worked for him, all these people that were in the political office, and yet my oldest brother is Liko Martin.
Oh.
So Liko and I grew up, I'm 20 years younger than Liko, and I actually grew up watching my brother back in the 70s when I was probably 6-7 years old, watching them actually be for the first time try to take a stand against the state during the when they took over Hawaii Kai, when there were all the pig farms back there. That was really the first stand. That, and then it went on to Kohol'awe and all of that. So I watched as a young boy, watched my oldest brother, like, at that time, everybody was calling them activists. These crazy activists. What are these Hawaiians doing? What are they, you know? But yet, I saw my father and my mom in this political system, Democratic Party and everything. But and as I grew older, I got to really see the truth and what the corruption within the system, and why my brother was fighting and what my brother was really fighting for. And I so admire my brother for doing so, and he's still going. And I think what you just spoke about with the indigenous, that Obama had signed this indigenous, I'm not sure exactly what you're talking about, but know that it was already, back in 1966, there's a National Historic Preservation Act that was signed by Teddy Roosevelt. Actually, it was created by Eleanor Roosevelt. That was rewritten for the Hawaiians in 2002. And as there was a whole handbook written for us regarding the National Historic Preservation Act. And within that act, there is what they call the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer, which falls in between the Department of Justice within the United States system. Now, for me, there's like it's a double-sided sword. Like, okay, we're gonna honor this, but yet they're still an illegal entity, in my eyes. But at the same time, we got a whole bunch of people that we live here on the island with, and that we gotta work with, whether we like it or not, whether I feel as strongly as I do that, yeah, the annexation was illegal, the overthrow was illegal. It's like if I stole your car and passed it and sold it to somebody else, and then they sold it to somebody else, and they sold it to somebody else, and finally they realize, oh, that's a stolen car. Whose car is it? That's the same thing that I see that's happened with our land, and I think there's a huge undertaking that needs to happen to change over a lot of the laws that have been done here. So under the National Historic Preservation Act, there's a Tribal Historic Preservation Officer position. And there were five of us that filed with every federal agency in the United States. And that was myself, Ed Kaivi, Kaimi Homosua, Ed Taniguchi, and Walter Apana. And anybody can do that. If you have the koko, you can actually do that. But you need to make sure that you get your paperwork in order, send it out, and have it certified mail by every federal agency. So it costs us about $600 to do that. But,
you know, that's the whole part about it, you know, I object to, is that you get your authority from a foreign government.
Yeah, me too.
So, we should not do that.
Okay.
From this foreign government.
Yeah, I feel the same way too. But that was part of the whole. I think for myself is in the process of actually being able to show that even that, because even after we did that, I actually been back and forth emailing Governor Abercrombie, asking him when he came up here if the state of Hawaii is ready to recognize the tribal historic preservation officers in their position. So after about 6 months, he back and forth emailing, he finally came out with this. After talking to my department heads and discussing the issue of the tribal historic preservation officers, we do not recognize it because in Hawaii there is no tribes and there's no reservations.
Mm-hmm.
So I have that all on email. But now, if you look at what's happening on Ehukarta, it's a whole nother, like, oh, now we're going to trade through this whole new Olawau, new...
Yeah, a commission role.
Yeah, commission role that they are now going to call us a tribe, right? The Hawaiian tribe. So there's all this, it's almost like we just have to stay in the conversation and not drop. But for myself, it's I didn't necessarily do that because I think that's going to hold the clout. I was pretty sure myself, Ed and Kaimi, more evidence of them not acknowledging what they are actually putting out there for us to stand on. Yeah, and I think
we shouldn't be satisfied with
that. Oh yeah. Definitely not.
Yeah. So I believe that we should stand behind a government, a Hawaiian government, and then all your authority and laws should come from there. Yeah. And then, you know, you want to do burials, do it through the Hawaiian government.
So, Justin, what happens when I'm listening to this and respecting all sides of the argument is that when we talk about keeping people safe, I'm not sure that these are the type of people that need to be locked up for holding on to their belief system. I appreciated that you did not go after James Olalem the last time he stood in front of the Ahu. He was arrested, but the charges were dropped.
You know, and what I've always said is that, you know, it's not my job to police people's political beliefs or police people's exercising of their cultural beliefs, their political beliefs, their religious beliefs, whatever that might be. You know, if that starts to turn into a situation where there's violence or some kind of violent behavior, then, you know, there's a place for the criminal justice system. But, you know, I respect people's rights to exercise their, you know, political and social autonomy. And, you know, as long as that's done in a way that doesn't leave people, you know, injured or subject to some kind of assaultive behavior, then...
So building on that, though, and asking both of these men, like when I look at what goes wrong in here, and I have to admit, I'm naive. I don't really understand addictive behavior. I don't understand a lot of the things that do go into crime. I think having a deep-seated cultural anger or frustration, which to me is very understandable, that can accelerate sometimes challenges, even when somebody's 8 years old, if they are forced in school to be somebody that they don't identify with. When you go to school, and I'm involved with schooling, so I'm conscious of this, when they don't identify with this very Western way that we condition the children to be in and move them so far away from the cultural foundations, it creates and instills a level of anger. And when we don't have the call on the air, I want to be looking at what are the statistics. Seems to me a disproportionate amount of Hawaiian people, Kanaka Maoli, are incarcerated relative to their place. Keo, I know you're going to be going off to this meeting soon, so I want to get your final thoughts. Kale?
Support a Hawaiian government that's out there. Okay? That's what's on the agenda with OHA. OHA's got to decide where their assets are going. So they have to pick up an entity that will accept the assets. And it's got to be a governmental entity, I believe, and that we'll find out tonight what's on the agenda.
Okay. Well, let me know tomorrow how it goes.
Okay.
Thank you, Kale.
Okay. Aloha.
Aloha.
Everybody.
Thank you. Aloha.
We have a very patient caller.
Hello?
You're on the air.
Hey, how's it? Hey, I just wanted to weigh in on two things real quick. I agree with what you guys are saying, but as far as licensing, like Hawaiian license, if it's not recognized at the federal level with the insurance companies, you know, I went through a motorcycle accident, and the county and the state have legalized rebuild bikes. So as long as you put Baja kits and the lights, the high-low beam and all that, and they were legalizing them, but they didn't put metal tanks. And luckily, when I had my accident, I wasn't the one at fault, no. So I was the victim. But the insurance companies, they run by real strict rules. And they come, and if your bike isn't to specs, as if your license isn't to specs, say, Hawaiian, get this Hawaiian license. And some drunk driver, take this scenario for the Kanak Maolis out there. You're running your Hawaiian license, brother. And you get banged on, drunk driver. Completely his fault. Even if you get arrested, when it comes to the insurance company, they don't recognize your license, you lose. That's how civil law works. Forget this. Recognizing you guys at the state level. Right? All that other stuff, yeah, but on the federal road that federal money pays for, right, you guys better get you guys act together, because when you guys get into an accident and you're the victim, you're gonna have to turn around and sue the state and the counties because they dropped the ball in protecting you. And then the other thing I wanna talk about to Justin is what's up with these cops when they do their special raids wearing masks? Like the Soviet stormtroopers, and you know, when some years back when I saw it, I wasn't even a protester. I just was witnessing when all the guys came for the super ferry. Every cop, most of them all had these masks and everything. You know, I don't really like this. We live in a pretty close-knit community, and you don't want the community to be afraid of the police. I mean, you want us to work with you, not be, like, angry with you guys. I mean, I know you're not the police, but, you know, and I like a lot of the cops, but when you guys bring in all these other guys from off islands and stuff, and they do ops over here, you know what I mean? It's what's up with the masks? How come they gotta wear masks?
Well, I'm glad you acknowledge that I'm not the police, because unfortunately, sometimes, as much as I wish I did, I don't have control over what they do. But, you know, I'm sure what I can say is that they do a very difficult job. In all seriousness, they do a very difficult job. They work very long hours. They place themselves in great harm's way to do what they do.
There's not many fatal police shootings in this county.
Right. And, you know, in the past few years, I understand why that is a subject of conversation here. And I think
right. I mean, the interjection of Homeland Security money has made them do things beyond what they're supposed to be doing for the county.
I like that he's bringing this up because, you know, this is an issue for me. I think that there is a prevalence of excessive use of force. Sometimes you get a SWAT team when a phone call would do.
Can I interject here? My daughter's a freshman in Kapaa High. And this year I went to the beginning day, you know, when the parents come, they bring them to the first day, they're the only ones on campus, but the other three grades don't start till the next day. And one of the speakers in the gym when the students went on their route was the policeman on campus. And I've heard from some of the teachers, they weren't happy that they tasered the boy on campus, first of all, last year, even though he was 18. But in his speech to me and the rest of the parents was talking about how one little fight in ninth grade can ruin their life. Isn't high school supposed to be where you learn how to get that out and redeal with it at the social level? Isn't it supposed to be ruining your life for the rest of your life? I got up and I got real in that cop's face and I told him that I serve too. I serve just like you, man. And if you get all paranoid like that, they win.
I agree.
Talking about all this Homeland Security stuff in high school, brother. I mean, it's a military. I know you're not them, but you see the cases that come across your desk.
I do, and I spend a lot of time, even this afternoon, directly before I came up here, we were sitting down with some folks from Hale Opio and folks from state mental health services and our internal juvenile court staff talking about ways that we can intervene.
This
and
is a four-time veteran from Iraq serving on our campus.
Thank you.
What's going on, bro? I'm a parent. I go ninth grader. My daughter is 4.0 all the way, top-of-the-line student. I don't got to worry about her. But what if there is a forced shootout because the students are so paranoid that they feel threatened by the cops and they escalate, and my daughter's caught in a crossfire?
Yeah, all I can say about that is, you know, I hear your concern. I'm as upset about the rising tide of violence that we're looking at as anyone else. I see the aftermath of the violence every single day.
When you speak of rising tide of violence, are they rising tide of police violence or people violence?
Yeah.
I mean, because those are two really important issues.
I let you guys go. I took up too much of your time. I just wanted to get that kind of spin on the conversation. You know, the Hawaiians, I love all the Hawaiians, everything, but the licensing, just make them free for them. All right, just let them go. Give them a regular state license for free. I'm with that. I'm a porch. I'll pay for them.
Thank you.
Okay. Hello.
He's actually bringing up some really important points, and I think this goes to a national issue, is when we have, at Hawaii, we have a relationship with the Correctional Corporation of America, correct?
The state of Hawaii does, yes.
Yes, it does. And so in Sai's case, your sentence, it seems like you were gone for 4 months or 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
How long were you in jail?
4 months.
4 months. So you get to stay here at KCCC, Kauai Community Correctional Center. So you stay in this somewhat nurturing environment where there is this element that goes back and forth. But if you have more than 2 years, you get shipped away.
Well, not only just more than 2 years. I'm glad you brought this.
I want to go somewhere with this. Okay.
So when I went into prison back in November, it was actually November 12th, okay, turned myself in, got booked, and figured I met with my attorney and I told him that, you know what, I no longer want to take this to trial. That I actually want to just plead no contest, get it over with. So John Colma, who was my attorney, said, well, that's great. Well, it should be a couple, you know, next week or a couple weeks from now, we'll find out from the prosecutor's office what they want to offer you, and I'll get back to you. So I'm thinking the following week, I'm going to be out. So I'm giving all my stuff away to my nephew, and, you know, like, oh, well, it's either this Tuesday or this Thursday, I'm going to be going, guys. So that conversation kept going on month after month after month. It was not until 3 months later did I actually hear and meet with my public defender. Now, by that time, I was already doing this reality training with the inmates,
right.
And it was really, I felt like I was called to be there and really could make a difference with them and work with them, and they worked with me, and it was really an empowering opportunity for me, so it was all right. But what did happen was, while I was there, the conversation that the warden often has is that our numbers are high and we're going to have to ship people out, which we did. There was actually two planes that left and took people out that not necessarily had 2 years. It depends on how Jerry Jonah decided who's going to go and who's not going to go. It's not up to the warden. Warden kind of pulled himself.
Who's Jerry Jonah?
Jerry Jonah is, he works at the jail, and he's, I guess, the
Yeah, I couldn't say what his title was, but
okay.
You know,
so
he's an administrator.
So anyway, there's.
So I want to get to something.
Yeah.
Though,
so there's a lot of. So we get people that are shipped out, and I think I'm not sure what happened that it took 3 months for them to decide, but I don't think the prosecutor's office would take that long to decide on what a third degree assault charge is going to take. Meanwhile, I had guys that came in with 5 days. That for the same charge as third degree assault, okay, you got 5 days and you can leave. So they, you know, it was, so I think there's a little breakdown either the public defender's office or really the caseload that he's handling or whatever. But I think the cost is that we end up sending guys that we're working with in the middle of making a really difference with get sent out. Now, just real quick before there, just the most recent case that happened with a good friend of mine that was in jail with me and was actually on pretrial with me that I worked with. And I think what we don't see, what Justin and them don't get to see, is the change that happens when they're in jail, incarceration.
Positive change.
Yeah, the positive change. And so, because if you read what was talked about a friend of mine, Mr. Dubin, and what his crime was, he got sentenced to 5 years, yeah? And he was, I can only say from my own experience, he was more than willing to accept, you know, that what he did. And but it seemed like, oh, he was this major threat to the community. And I'm sure he was at one time, and he's acknowledged that to me. But there's been such a great change with his attitude and really working. I wish that the prosecutors, it would be really great if the prosecutors would spend just a week in jail.
Well, that's a good idea.
If they went there
what
for
do you
a
think
week,
of that?
Just to really see, like, wow, what's really happening? Because yeah. you and no,
I would
not,
like to
not
have
only
that
the
experience.
Prosecutors, but really,
that
yeah, people. Because you get to see what we read out on the newspapers is really what happened, but we don't get to see the big difference that the change that they're going through and what it takes for them to make that change.
So what I heard from you last week is for you it was a really super positive experience, and I'm happy for that. And I know sometimes it isn't a super positive experience for some people, but where I'm trying to go with this line of questioning, I'll just throw them out there, and then Justin, you can kind of look at it a little bit, is we have a national crisis of over-incarceration, and we have a for-profit prison industry. So we have, most of the time, I haven't seen lately Kauai or Hawaii's agreement with Correctional Corporations of America, but generally speaking, they require a 90% occupancy. So it becomes a big for-profit business to be incarcerating people. So there becomes a machine that requires people to go in there. And then when we get these grants, I mean, for this just unbelievable amount of hardware that the police department has, I mean, they just basically got a tank. You know, I mean, here people don't even have to lock their houses. You make the paper for stealing a pack of cigarettes, and we are armed to fight the Al-Qaeda. And they go to do a sweep on warrants that are out, and I mean, these are real stories that I know for a fact are situations because I've helped people where they come busting onto houses when it's, you know, somebody's car got a flat tire in the wrong place and they're banging on the door, and an 8-year-old's hiding underneath the kitchen cabinets, just terrified when her mother went up to the store. You know, I think, oh, honey, don't hide under the cabinets, you could end up being shot. You know, you have to answer the door. But a phone call would have worked. You know, there's plenty of situations when a phone call would have worked. And then, so I'm jumping a little bit here.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I can't really, you know, answer to you why a particular operation is structured a particular way. I can tell you that there are, by the same token, situations where police go out in the community to do what they're going to do in a situation where they're going to not expect any trouble whatsoever, and they end up with bullets coming at them. So police are people too, and our police aren't all perfect. Prosecutors aren't all perfect. Folks out in the community aren't all perfect. And sometimes people make mistakes and things go wrong.
But these are terrible mistakes. These are terrible. And, these are violent,
and when those
terrifying mistakes. When they go with this level of force, they create long-lasting trauma. And I am one of those. I call it my police traumatic stress disorder. And we need to work to stop that. And it might not be the prosecutor, but we need to look at how do we sit there and have some review process when a phone call, because people don't even know that there's a warrant. I never had a warrant, by the way. But when somebody doesn't know that they have a warrant, and that they would at least get a call or a letter that says, hey, you didn't pay your traffic fine. You know, we're going to come with 8 armed cops that are in masks with heavy guns, artillery, just in case you're home. You know, I mean, that to me, that's a crime. To go and be so violent at somebody's doorstep, that's a crime also. And like in the case of the mom and child that I was speaking of, she lost her housing over it. She lost her housing over it because the landlord didn't want somebody who has the police coming that way. And she, the girl had no idea she had a warrant out. I called. I found out that she did for a flat tire. So, I mean, these are issues. I know it's not directly you, but it is. I mean, I can prove all of it. These are huge issues, and it's national. It's not just Kauai, and it comes from the Patriot Act. I've researched it. And I can prove a lot of this. This is very, very frightening. And there is no recourse to complain. You can go to the police commission, but the police commission are basically powerless. The mayor can't do anything. The county council can't do anything. And so there's this excessive use of force that tends to become rather typical. And I would say the other thing that happens is people get arrested for something. And like what we are hearing a little bit with Cy, I mean, they might be out on the streets for 4 years in the adjudication process, and they eventually go spend their 3 months in jail or something like that. But it derails their life. I meet so many young people that I've known since they're very little. And it's almost a form of slow genocide because it keeps them out of their breeding period, especially when they get incarcerated at 19 years old till they're 32, they don't get better after that point. It's hard to recover. And so it breaks my heart to see this pattern that happens a lot. I'll let you respond for a moment, then I have to do the top of the hour break.
Sure. And, you know, I think we're very fortunate on Kauai in that we don't see a large percentage of people being incarcerated from the time they're 19 until the time they're 32. But I, you know, the point you make is a good point. And the percentage of the number and quantity and volume of folks incarcerated in Hawaii has increased, you know, dramatically since the late 1970s. I mean, almost 1,000%. And
why?
Because of, you know, certainly because of some of the things that you talked about. I think we've got a drug problem in the community of a radically different type than what existed in the 1970s. I think the crystal methamphetamine and prescription opioid abuse does very serious damage to the brains of folks who get embroiled in those drugs, and makes it very, very difficult for them to ever, you know, rejoin the community as healthy participants. And so there are situations that come up where they keep getting in trouble over and over and over again because, you know, so much of their brains have been rewired to the point where they can't participate the way that other folks like us can participate. And the systematic dismantling, I think, of the mental health treatment infrastructure in the country at a federal and state level has forced the criminal justice system into a position where it's really essentially You know, we're the social workers of last resort because the other social work agencies have been cut so badly that they're not able to keep on top of the situation in the community. We see, you know, mental health calendars now in the courts that are far more extensive than anything that we dealt with even 5 or 10 years ago. You know, we see tremendous amount of resources and assets from both the judiciary and from our office and from the cops out on the street who are dealing with folks who, you know, a lot of them, they need mental health treatment and they're not getting it in the community for whatever reason. And so, you know, what happens? Some petty crime or some, you know, pattern of repeated petty crime comes up and the cops are the only ones there to deal with it. And then it comes into the laps of the judiciary and the prosecutor's office. So I think it's a product of a lot of different societal factors. I think the fact that we've got a for-profit corrections company that the state does business with, you know, is something that nobody is really satisfied with. I know the governor made it a priority of his to bring inmates that are housed on the mainland back to Hawaii for the reasons that you described, because of the interruption in family lives, the trauma that's inflicted by having a loved one who's incarcerated on the mainland. You know, OHA did a pretty good study that came out in 2010 that described the disproportionate impact of the criminal justice system on the Native Hawaiian population. And it you know, anybody that's concerned about this issue would be really, in my opinion, very well served to take a look at that report, because it really does highlight in stark black and white terms, you know, what the numbers are, what the percentage is in the population. That's, you know, the 24% of the population that is, you know, Native Hawaiian, and the fact that the percentage of folks who are incarcerated, 27% of all arrests, 33% of people in pretrial detention, 29% of people sentenced to probation, 36% admitted to prison in 2009. You know, when you've got 36% of the prison population that's Native Hawaiian, when only 24% of your larger population is Native Hawaiian, that signifies that there's something that really needs to be looked at and analyzed. You know, 39% of releases on parole and 41% of parole revocations as of 2010, Native Hawaiian population. You know, and they made other findings. Given a determination of guilt, Native Hawaiians are more likely to get a prison sentence than all other groups, according to the Hawaii Criminal Justice Data Center. These are facts that are real black and white facts.
Thank you for sharing them. You are listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K284 AL Haleiwa. This is Felicia with Kauai Soapbox. Joining me in the studio is Sai Shim and Chief Prosecutor Justin Kohler. And Kauai Soapbox is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with Coldwell Banker, Bali High Realty, Anahola Stringed Instruments, Aya's Garden, and Al Pastor Tacos.
Coldwell Banker, Bali High Realty, and Hanalei, serving Kauai since 1978, providing personalized real estate sales and rental services. Coldwell Banker, Bali High Realty, also supports KKCR and the Kauai Independent Food Bank. More information at balihigh.com or by calling 826-7244.
Anahola Stringed Instruments is proud to support KKCR. Mickey Sussman has been building island koa guitars, ukulele, and violins on Kauai since 1972. Time-honored designs and special orders. Prompt and complete restoration, repair, and reforestation. AnaholaStringedInstruments.com or 822-1645.
Aya's Garden, all-natural garden and greenhouse supply. In Kapa'a, down Kukui Street from the Dragon Building. Fertilizers, amendments, soil, seeds, garden and farm organic growing supplies. Open Monday through Saturday. More information at 822-7333 or visit Aya's Garden on Facebook.
Al Pastor Tacos supports KKCR across the street from the craft fair in Kapa'a by the beach. Al Pastor Tacos serves fresh grilled local fish, steak, chicken, and pork tacos and burritos in the Al Pastor style. Also a garden salad and choices for the kids. Open every day from 11 to 4. Takeout orders welcome. Al Pastor Tacos, authentic Mexican food. 652-6953.
And mahalo for supporting Kauai Community Radio. I have a very patient caller. You're on the air.
Hi. Mr. Shim? Is that your name?
Yes.
You're a very cool guy. I like you a lot. And I know, Justin, you're trying to do the best you can, and I think you're a good attorney. You know, even though I don't think the problem has to do with drugs and brain damage. Because, I mean, you could look at it like this way. Look at all the people that go to war and create war. I mean, is something wrong with them mentally? Or people that are racist, you know, or bigots, you know? What's up with their mental capacity, you know? You know, I think it has more to do with the lack of opportunity in this society where everything, the cost of living is so much. Even for education, like, what's a kid going to do? He wants to be a doctor, you know, how's he going to pay for it? And then it also has to do with bad parenting. I mean, if you want to incarcerate, especially like juveniles in jail for possession of drugs and this and that, maybe you should take the parents along for a ride, you know, because there's this cycle. There's also a lot of cultural oppression in Hawaii. You know, I mean, it's a small island. People, even local people that have lived here for generations, they go, they're like stuck. Where can I go? It costs money. You know, I need to travel. I need to find a new life. But they're stuck in it. They get stuck in a rut where they don't know what to do, right?
So thank you, caller. What's your question?
This is the last thing I'll say. And besides, there's so much hypocrisy in the world, you know, about like you were saying, the lady who had a traffic citation for a flat tire, and all of a sudden police are breaking down her door in riot gear. It's absurd, right? But in Democracy Now!, which I think everybody should listen to today, they talked about Wall Street crime. And these, and you know, a little drug peddler, a nickel and dime drug peddler who'll go to jail for years for like sales of a small amount of a controlled substance, where these billionaire, multimillionaire corporate executives of Wall Street banks that end up having to pay millions and billions of dollars worth of fines, nobody ever goes to jail. And that's the society, the culture of hypocrisy that we live in, that if you're trying to educate children when they're youngsters, you know, they're totally confused as to what's right and wrong.
So thank you for those observations.
Anyways, thank you for the show, Felicia.
Okay, aloha. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that in my opinion, I think it's time for people to stand up and take action, and stop talking, and start taking action. We all know who sells drugs on this island. We all know who they are. And
I don't.
Sick, well, a lot of us do, and a lot of people out there do, and they're not taking action. They're not calling the prosecutor and saying, why are you not going to this house, to that person? I think some of it is fear. Some of us just don't want to have a target on our back. I think, apathy, we're all busy in our lives, but we will pay the price in the future if we don't come together and say enough is enough. If you guys want to sell drugs, beat it, get out of here. We don't want you on Kauai. Go to Oahu, go to Maui, go to the mainland. You're not welcome here. We want our keiki to grow up strong and healthy, mentally, physically, and spiritually. You're not welcome here if you want to sell drugs, period. And I'm not afraid. I'll call the cops on my neighbor. I don't give a shit. I'm gonna turn you guys in. So any drug dealers, any friends of drug dealers that are out there, look out, because we've had it. We've had enough, and we're not gonna take it anymore.
Thank you, caller.
We love you, Felicia.
Okay. Aloha, you're on the air.
Hello? Hello? Hello?
You're on the air. You're on the air.
You know what?
Okay, you just are calling back.
I know, and I'll be really quick.
30 seconds.
Okay, people don't have to buy drugs. I don't have to go into Safeway. I can buy GMO-free products. I can buy organic. It's not the drug dealer's fault, per se. It's the parents. It's the people that are buying the drugs. I'm smart enough not to do that.
Okay, thank you, caller.
If you can't raise your children to be smart enough, then the parents are, it's their fault.
Thank you, caller.
Okay.
Okay, so he brought up, she brought up really important points about the drugs, and I have to acknowledge my naivete on crystal meth. And, you know, I look back in the early 80s when I moved here and we had a pretty thriving, what I would call alternative agriculture business. People were growing bud to where you could smell the fresh breeze down the street, and people don't tend to beat their wives on a sedative like marijuana. I'm not saying that that necessarily needs to be here, but boy, it was a mistake to transplant, you know, a gentle drug, high financially yielding one, to seemingly a pretty gnarly one.
Well, yeah, and that goes back to kind of what I was touching on before, in that the drug problem that we have today is not the drug culture that existed in the 1970s or the 1960s or even the 1980s. You know, crystal methamphetamine is a really insidious thing, and it's something that once people are addicted to, it's very hard to climb A, out of that addiction, and climb B, back into a position of being a productive and contributing individual in society. And the same goes for the prescription opioid addictions as well. These drugs are so much more powerful and so much more addictive and so much more available than things were, you know, a generation or two ago. You know, couple that with an economic environment where folks don't have a ton of opportunities, and you've got a recipe for trouble. If you've got a lot of bored young people that can't find good jobs and that don't have those opportunities to get educated and gain skills, gain life experience, you're more likely, and, you know, the research has demonstrated this pretty thoroughly, you're more likely to end up with a generation of folks who are looking for other ways to either, gain a different set of awarenesses, or forget about or numb themselves against the bad things that are happening in their lives. If they're witnessing a lot of abuse or trauma in the home, they're going to be more likely to turn to substances that are going to take their minds off of those things or make them forget about it for just a short period of time.
And so, this particular drug is one that can bring out violence. Si, you spoke last time about how you did totally overcome that, and then I've since talked to two different people, one who also is a Qigong person. They did really totally get over it, and you can move past it. Not easy, but yeah, you can.
Yeah, and you know, the majority, they don't. Justin is very, it's really hard. Now, being in jail for the 4 months that I was, it's real clear that all the guys that were in there that were on crystal meth or opiates, that they're fine without it. And that, more than anything else, is what we as a community, as not only in the state, on this island, but everywhere where it's being affected on the world, people need to really realize that, really get that it's okay that you don't need it, because these guys are in there and they're fine. They're not like they're dying. They're not shaking and having withdrawals like they were on heroin or anything else. And they may have some withdrawals at the beginning. But like the caller that said, you know, yeah, we don't want the drug dealers here anymore. And we don't want the drugs. I want to take a whole nother look at something else, too, that happened to a friend of mine, Ariel Moore, the one who got shot in Anahola.
Mm-hmm.
So we incarcerated Vinny for shooting Ariel, right? Now, there's, yeah, Vinny committed that crime. and he's doing very good as far as I saw in KCCC. And I was very good friends with Ariel, and I met Ariel's father and spoke to Ariel's father, and I think the whole community was upset over what happened. And part of, in my eyes, part of the problem was, or who should also be incarcerated, is the federal government for allowing it to get to that point where this guy, Ariel, who was actually injured on the job, who was a great surfer, great jiu-jitsu guy, suddenly needed some painkillers and started using OxyContin. Well, year later, he's still using OxyContin, and they're giving him as much as he wants, whenever he wanted them, and he just became so addicted to it. I've heard of people that have had broken arms that had OxyContin given to them, and a year and a half later, they're still getting OxyContin for their broken arm. So it was there. At some point, the government's got to say, well, or even the prosecutor's office and us as a community needs to say, wait a minute. That's what happened. That's what we're reading about in the paper. But what's really behind all of that was that the FDA allowed for this drug with the pharmaceutical companies. The pharmaceutical companies need to be held responsible and accountable for what they've created here.
Right. And I know, and I've met seniors, and I'll be very vague, but I have a handful of friends who are kupuna who almost would rather die than go off it. And it's really difficult now for them to be able to go to the doctor to get it. And they literally contemplate suicide as opposed to not using it. And they are basically good, kind, productive people, and that's something they seem to need. We have a patient caller. You're on the air.
Yeah, it goes a lot deeper than that. We're talking about doctors that are getting money to pretty much push drugs.
Exactly.
No, nobody sees that side of it. You got nurses, you have doctors that are basically given funds.
Yeah.
They're sent on vacations to push drugs.
Yeah.
Well, we do see that part of it. Yeah.
Going on, then, you know, things might change. But as far as everybody thinks right now, it's a bunch of drug dealers, you know, selling drugs. It goes way deeper than that, way deeper. You know, we're not talking about Pocololo here. We're not talking about an herb. We're talking about pharmaceutical drugs, man-made drugs.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct, and thank you for pointing that out, because, you know, the pills that come here and end up in the underground economy, in the underground drug economy, are all items that are manufactured legally and come here presumably legally as part of the above-ground legal pharma economy. You know, those pills are manufactured in a clean and sterile, pristine factory somewhere, shipped here with, you know, paperwork that describes their lineage and where they came from and how many are there and what the dosage is, and they're prescribed by a doctor who presumably has been through lots of education and dosed out by a pharmacist who has licenses and credentials and certifications. And then they end up, you know, 10 steps later in the hand of somebody who is living with a crippling addiction, or somebody who is on the cusp of developing a crippling addiction, or in some cases, a patient who really needs the medication. But we have so much of it being diverted now, and, you know, the pharmaceutical industry is in large part, you know, I don't think there's anybody that would deny that they're to blame in large part for what has happened with these medications, and that there are doctors out there who are complicit in prescribing these medications in situations where maybe there are alternative therapies that would suffice. So, you know, I agree there needs to be much more done in terms of monitoring how these pills come in and what happens to those pills once they get here. And I think that's something that the law enforcement community in general is, you know, extremely concerned about. And I myself have been, you know, ringing the alarm bells about that since, you know, I started working on these cases back in, you know, 2009, is that, you know, we do have a problem with how these pills are being disseminated into the community. And, you know, we do very much see that side of it. We see the reports when they come in of, you know, folks who are in their 20s or early 30s or even younger, and they're coming in and we're discovering needles in their possession. And, you know, that's something that we didn't see here before. So it's somewhat alarming.
Yeah, Ashley, I wanted to point that out, Justin. I know you're saying, you know what, the drug problem now compared to how it was in the 80s or the 70s is a lot different. I think it's even way more. I mean, just in that 4 months that I was incarcerated, I was shocked because it's more different this year than it was last year. I mean,
in what way?
In that I got to hear from brothers and sisters that their little brothers and sisters that are in middle school are shooting up drugs on Kauai.
What kind of drugs?
Oxycontin, all kinds of different opiates. But it's just the fact that they're shooting up drugs. Like, oh, my God. Everybody was shocked. But it's happening, and it's happening. And it's like almost this trend that you're starting to hear, like, not just one or two. I'm talking like a lot of people have been coming into the prison talking about, oh, yeah, I heard your sister was shooting up and she's 16 or she's 14 or she's 12. And it's unbelievable. It's unreal. And you start to hear the inmates, you start to hear the inmates going, oh, my God, what have I done? That's my, you know, that's my cousin. That's my, oh, you know, and it's, we all need to wake up to it. And at another thing that I just wanted to point out is, as a Hawaiian, I think sometimes we, along the way, we used what happened to us as a nation, as a kingdom, as an excuse to go on and not be responsible for ourselves. We sometimes use it like, oh, it's, well, I'm going to go use drugs then. I'm going to go party. Yeah, well, the hell with the U.S. They don't ever, like, acknowledge us. Well, screw
no
them. Yeah, I'm going to do whatever I like. And part of whatever I like turns into, well, I'm going to use drugs. And then they use it as an excuse, like, well, see, you guys did that to us, and now we're going to, you guys the one had us use drugs. But really, and this is just a shout out to all the Hawaiians out there, bro. Can't use that one. I just wanna say that it's not, but it's your choice. Don't blame the United States government for us using drugs.
And thank you on that. So something I'm hearing, just to clarify, a big issue right now for this 1,000% increase in arrests is in many ways related to drug use. A simple yes on that, or and I got two callers holding.
Short answer, yes.
So it sounds like we need a medical facility. I don't know. I'm so committed to trying to keep our people not incarcerated. I know people who are in a different economic class that have these same problems. And they go through family shame and all that, but they go and they put themselves in a rehab clinic and they get better.
Yeah, and we need to do everything we can as a community to make sure that there are treatment resources there for folks who do want to get clean. You know, there are folks out there who have drug problems who, you know, legitimately, they're not interested in getting clean. They're not in the right place in their life. They're not in the right time. They're not in the right headspace. They don't want to go on probation because they know they're going to get caught again, so they just take their jail time. We see that happening. But for folks there who do want to make the effort and get clean, you know, from a criminal justice perspective, it's much smarter for us to spend money on that because we're not going to, you know, if we can get these people the intervention that they need to not reoffend, then we're going to be, you know, the economic benefit is there and it's very real. So, you know, we do have a drug court program on Kauai that, you know, our office wholeheartedly supports. It's a judiciary program, and, you know, we pump as many people, you know, into it as we can, because if we've got somebody that's got a an addiction related illness, it's our preference that they deal with it in that way, if they want to do it. If they don't want to do it, if they're not interested in getting clean, fine. We're not going to spend the money on getting them clean. We're not going to put them in a spot that we could put somebody else in there who does want to, you know, beat this problem. Very happy to do that. So, again, it becomes a little bit of a situation of us becoming kind of the social stop of last resort for folks who don't have the resources, like you mentioned, or the personal privilege or the personal wealth to go out and enter that rehab facility, that private rehab facility, or spend the thousands and thousands of dollars that it takes to get that. But, you know, we're committed. You know, part of my mission in making a safer and healthier community is ensuring that folks who want to change their lives have the opportunities or have meaningful opportunities to do that, because otherwise we're just going to be warehousing them at KCCC or, you know, Saguaro or wherever else the case may be, and that's not serving the community in the long run. We want to save those spots for folks who really need to be out of circulation.
Thank you. And you are listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea, K284AL, Haleiwa, Kauai Soapbox. This is Felicia with Chief Prosecutor Justin Kohler and Cy Shim. I have a bunch of calls holding. Aloha, you're on the air.
Aloha. I have a question for Justin. As part of my job, I have to research grants that are available for post-secondary education and for education K through 12. And one of the things that I'm seeing a lot of money out there for is for drug programs for younger people, work release programs for people who are coming out who have a more positive attitude. And I was wondering if the county is taking advantage of going after any of this grant money to try and set up some programs to help people.
I know the county as a whole does. I can tell you that my office is not set up to really manage treatment programs or manage social services programs, but I do know that the Department of Public Safety does have a fairly robust program when it comes to work furloughs and work release, and that often involves different components that have treatment with them. And I can tell you that the county's Life Choices coordinator, Teresa Koki, does a lot of work in trying to identify those grant resources when they're out there, bring them in, and then get them routed out to the folks who can make the best difference using them out in the community.
I'd certainly like to help you guys on that. If you can tell me a website, because I see these things every day, and I see opportunities. I go, wow, look at that one, look at that one. And, you know, it's not my clue. I'm not doing that. I'm trying to find ways to get stipends for kids, to get internships, to get kids to go and get an education after high school, and you know, which I think is also going to contribute to having a healthier population.
Yeah, and that's what. Thank you. Thank you for being part of the solution in your community. It's essential for people to step up and do those kinds of things. So why don't we interface offline? You can send me an email at prosecutor@kauai.gov. Or call up the office, 241-1888, and email is probably, honestly, a better way to do it. If you can shoot me a message and just say, you know, some contact information, we can link up, and maybe I can put you in touch with some folks who you can make a positive difference with.
Yeah, it would be really good. There's also been money out there for juvenile court, for supporting working in juvenile court, so I'll send you all of these.
Yeah, thank you. We're very fortunate. I get to give a shout out here. We're very fortunate in this community to have a juvenile court judge like Edmund DeCoba, who spent many years working as a public defender handling juvenile court cases. I used to be juvenile court prosecutor here and had dozens, if not hundreds, of cases with him. And he's a guy that really does believe in working to find what's in the best interest of the child. Also, Hale Opio, who runs the teen court program here on Kauai, and all the people who assist and volunteer with that, because that is a program designed to provide interventions for youth who are at risk of getting involved in the criminal justice system, and basically do everything they can to prevent those young folks from getting onto a path that they have a hard time getting off of. So thank you for your involvement, and keep it up.
People interested in that kind of thing could contact your office and find out more information?
They could either find out more information, or I would do my very utmost to put them in touch with the folks who could give them the information they're looking for.
Great. Thanks so much, Justin.
Sure, aloha.
Thank you. Aloha, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
This is for Felicia and Mr. Kohler. Can we have a call anonymous, stay anonymous? Because I have friends, honest, who get like 360 oxys a month, and then they take so many and then they sell, and they're getting $20 and $30 a pill. And when you are strung out, that money is very tempting. I so understand that. I see the whole picture. But maybe we have to go back to the doctors who are prescribing this stuff. And I also knew, I just think call anonymous, stay anonymous would be a good thing. If we could have a number to call, and then people could check the story out.
The Kauai Police Department does have, there are two things. There's a Crime Stoppers number that folks can call, and I think they have the option of remaining anonymous there. And there's also what they have is a suspicious activity online reporting form through the Kauai.gov or the KPD portion of the Kauai.gov website. There's a form folks can go on, and if they have information they want to submit into law enforcement, they can do it there and stay in an anonymous way. And so that information is always helpful for law enforcement. It, you know, folks in the community are our eyes and ears in a lot of cases, because, you know, when folks see cops driving around or see the undercover narcotics officer, that they know who they are because it's a small island, you know, they tend to conceal their activity. And so it often falls to folks in the community to let us know what they're seeing or what you're seeing out there. So please do that while, you know, of course, remaining safe and keeping yourself safe.
Okay, but why would a doctor give a patient that many pills a month when they know how dangerous they are? That obviously the person is strung out, and obviously they're going to start selling them because they need money and get high.
That's a great question, and I don't know if there's a good answer for it.
Okay, thank you for your time. I do have your bumper sticker on my car. Vote for you.
Mahalo.
Thank you, Felicia.
Thank you. Aloha, thank you for holding. You're on the air.
Hey, aloha.
Aloha.
Hi, yes, I'm calling about, I just turned on the radio when the Native Hawaiian guy was on a little while ago, and I would just like to, it's kind of a solution to a whole lot of stuff you guys bring up on here about the Hawaiian nation, the reinstated Hawaiian nation, and the Hawaiian kingdom law that is actually the proper jurisdiction. And I don't know, I know the Prime Minister Henry Noah had discussions with the Chief of Police and the Mayor, and there's some progress, mostly on Maui, the most progress, but bottom line is, the whole drug thing is like on the list of victimless crimes. I'm not justifying the stuff that goes on behind it, or, you know, the corruption at all levels of that game, but the bottom line, like I said, is that Hawaiian Kingdom Law, you know, is the actual proper authority. And that the whole treatment thing for addiction, all that stuff as a whole, you know, so it doesn't belong in the judicial system. You know, the community, or the churches, you know, or the community, there should be other solutions besides besides the courts and the judicial process is not the proper arena. You know, especially particularly the American judicial process that doesn't have any actual legitimate legal authority here. So anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there. And, you know, I don't know if you're going to agree. You probably won't agree, you know, being part of the system and stuff. But I just wanted to put that out there to clarify, you know, the legality of it. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Aloha.
So this is Sai. I think he's right, and the proof is in the pudding, that we as the American judicial system, if you look at the incarceration rate and what's happened with the drugs, what we've been doing has been insufficient to to solve the problem. Whatever we're doing, it ain't working. Whatever we've done, it hasn't worked. So, you know, we can point the finger at everybody. You can point it at the prosecutor, you can point it at the police, the doctors, everybody, but what are we as an individual, as a community, as a state, as a country, as just as basic human beings that care for each other, what are we going to do? What steps can we take, or what we need? First of all, I feel we need to keep the conversation alive. We got to really get together and really look. Like, to give an example, Jimmy Rodello and I, we spoke this past Friday. And prior to going to the Friday night dinner, Jimmy said, well, Cy, you could handle a couple guys, yeah? When they come out, you could take care of a couple guys and make sure that they're good and, you know, support them in working it. And I could probably take a couple guys. So I thought, yeah, Jimmy, yeah, I would totally trust Jimmy with two guys, and I could probably take two guys. So I actually asked that question in the jail to the inmates. But my question was, how many of you don't think you could handle one person when you got out? How many of you don't think you could handle one person? And there wasn't a person in there that rose their hand. So what I got to see is that everybody incarcerated, if we really, because really, Warden often says it too, is that the best counselors or the best people that can help us that were in prison are the prisoners themselves, are the drug addicts themselves that have been drugged. That there's nobody else that has the knowledge, the insight, the wherewithal, really knows what it's like to have to stay up all night for days and then really dealing with it and all the lies and all the everything, everything that goes on with it. So everybody I asked was like, yeah, I could handle one, but how do we set that up? How could we, like, when people get out, okay, part of your probation is, you got to have one person win when they get out. And when that person gets out, you got to now take on one person. I don't know. It was just a thought. But it was something that, you know, the reality is that whatever we're doing isn't working, and we got to do something.
Yeah, that's a great thought, as far as I'm concerned. And absolutely, positively the right way to look at things. And, you know, you hit the nail on the head. What we're doing isn't working, so we need to try something new, and we each need to take responsibility to do what we can do. You know, I've decided that this path that I'm working on is the best way that I can be of service to the community right now in my life. And, you know, we all, I think Felicia does that in her way, and I see you doing that in your way. So I think it's, you know, it does fall to all of us as a community to stand up and do that. So,
and we need to somehow figure out why those 12-year-olds are making a wrong choice. We have a lot of callers who want to talk. Aloha, you're on the air.
Hey, great show.
Thank you.
This issue that you are attempting to address here is a world issue. Drug abuse, alcoholism, these are all issues of the human condition. And when you look at the human condition, I think the biggest problem there is, according to the geneticists, we're 97% monkey ass, right? So if we're 97% monkey in our biology, we got a whole ton of monkey behaviors that we may need to shed somehow. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, because the rest of the iceberg behind that is the monetary issues and vast criminal empires that profit on this same mayhem that the human condition is immersed in. And if you can attempt to address those issues without getting your head blown off and handed to you in this world, I don't know how you do it. But I think you're on the right track. You got to go public with all this, but you got to go public from the top down. And we've got vast criminal issues in this nation that have never been addressed in the last 10 years that deal completely with the elite's control of our nation and how they manipulate our system for their profit and our detriment. and the legal system is part and parcel to it. And well, what Americans need to figure out is the states created the Constitution, and the states are the guys that are in the business to police the federal government. And these issues that go right back to the federal government essentially come right back to the various state houses in the 50 states to deal with their elected officials in Washington that can't seem to, you know, see past the dollar signs.
I want to jump in and say I am in agreement with you that really all these problems come from a systemic relationship where our broad system really does applaud a corruption, you know, at, particularly at a corporate level. And so I think it is much, much deeper than just the people on the street with a problem.
You know, and there's no way to deny that there are systemic, you know, issues with how society approaches, you know, drug policy, approaches drug use, approaches treating drug addicts. But in the meantime, you know, I'm awful glad that there are folks down here, you know, kind of at the ground level to deal with, you know, the nuts and bolts of what do we do when somebody with a drug habit goes into somebody's house, for example, and steals some things to go feed their habit. You know, those are things, real world things that need to be dealt with at a nuts and bolts level. Or what do we do with folks who are coming out of an incarceration and need to make a reentry into society? How do we make sure we provide on the ground the resources that folks need to, okay, I got up in the morning, what do I do now? Who am I going to talk to that's going to help me make some good decisions about how I approach my day? Because those are very fundamental issues that are very real and affect everybody's daily lives in a much more concrete way than, you know, the larger philosophical issues of the human condition and our DNA and the 97% that is, you know.
No, I agree with you completely.
Non-human.
But, you know, this comes down to a people issue.
Sure, yeah. Absolutely.
You know, and people are the base of the problem. You know, and we got to get over our thinking that keeps us in this rut of, first, we've got to destroy the economic incentives for this to all happen. Hello?
Yeah.
Right?
I too, totally agree with you. There's that. But what Justin just said is so true on a very fundamental level.
It is.
Of, I just woke up, I just was incarcerated last night, but now I'm free. What do I do? Where do I go? And I can tell you it's so real for me because yesterday Jimmy calls me up. We were out working, and Jimmy calls me, and he said, "Sai, one of the guys I just went to meet probation, and one of the guys just got released. And now he's calling me. He's down in Kapaa, and he doesn't know what to do, and he's just kind of like in disarray." And so while Friday night when we went to talk to the inmates, I told the warden, "I can leave you my number, and for everybody, if you guys come out and you need somebody to talk to or call us." So we did. He did. He called us, and we went and grabbed him. We went and got him, and we took him home with us last night, and he was with us last night. And you know, it's kind of, you gotta, like Sergeant Whitey told us at the end, he said, "You know, that's really great, but you got to really be careful, too, because we're dealing with criminal minds." So I know that. Jimmy knows that. But I can't let that stop me from doing or trying to help. And
well,
you know,
and you're on the scene. You get to make the judge of this guy's character.
Yeah. And it happens so. I mean, it's like if Jimmy didn't do that and went and grabbed him, he could be gone already. He could be done. He could be back into using drugs and doing some stupid stuff. And I think we need to be there for each other more so than we really, I mean, we all say that and you guys can hear that, like, wow, that's really cool and that's really great. But really, like, if there's friends that you have that are incarcerated, like, find out when they're getting out. Find out what they need when they get out. To be bombarded with love and appreciation and compassion and knowing that they were incarcerated, it would make a huge difference for when somebody comes out of prison that they got a whole bunch of friends and family calling them, seeing what they need. That would make a huge difference. And I know for myself, I was so blessed with people checking on me and when I came out. And it's, you know, it just, I think we just need to do that. Just like what you said, it's a human condition.
You grew up in the family you grew up in.
Yeah, well, that too.
A lot of people don't have
that. Exactly. So for those that don't, we need to be there for them too. Because really, whether they're my brothers or sisters, I think we're on this island, and one of the great things about this island is that there's one thing I know for sure that we have in common, that we love this place. So if we stand on that commonality of our appreciation for this island, just know that we all have at least something in common. And even if they don't, they're not your brothers or sisters, that you reach out to each other. And even despite our differences and our disagreements.
And thank you, caller. I've got a handful of others stacked up.
Thanks for the show. Bye-bye.
Aloha, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Victoria. How's it going, you guys?
Good. I think you need to turn your radio off.
I just did. Sorry about that. Is that better?
Yes.
All right. So what you folks are talking about, I think, is all real important and good and fine, but my thought about it is that it needs to start before that person that's been incarcerated gets out. I think that there need to be more programs inside the system, inside the cell block, that sets people up to be functioning human beings once they're back out on the street. I know from experience, because I spent a couple days in jail, it wasn't a very fun time, but it was a very interesting learning experience for me. And what I found was I felt lower than a dog at the Humane Society. I found myself whacking my head on the little glass window because there was nothing to do. They put everybody inside there, and unless you are fortunate enough to be outside at LTF, which is Lifetime Stan, which gives you possibilities, but if you're inside that cell block, you sit there for all but three meals, and meals are 20 minutes each, and you do nothing. You can read books. You can read the Bible. You can go to a religious class for 15 minutes a day if you wish. But the rest of the time, you spend waiting and wondering and hoping and praying, and really, it's really a waste. My thought is use the folks, you know, make them learn stuff, you know, while they're in there to prepare them from being, you know, just another, you know, stuck on the sidewalk doing nothing, wasting their life, or, you know, ripping somebody else off, you know, to get drugs again once they're out. Because really, I think the statistics show that it's anywhere from 80% to 90% of the folks that come out go right back to it. And I know that 8 out of 10 women that lose their children because of drugs, only 2 out of those 10 ever get their children back. And I believe it's all about education. So I think we need to address education and preparedness inside, you know, as well as, you know, the welcoming, supportive family, you know, once they're out. Aloha.
Aloha, thank you. And we are almost at the top of the hour, not quite. Jazz with John will be on at 6 o'clock. We have one more caller. Aloha, you're on the air.
Aloha.
Aloha.
Whatever happened to the idea that they were going to have a drug rehab center here on Kauai?
Do you know, Justin?
It is, to the best of my knowledge, in process in terms of the planning aspect of it. I know that the mayor has been very forthright in his desire to get an adolescent residential drug treatment center up and running here on the island of Kauai, and that you know, that process is not a quick process. It's something that you know, actually started many, many years ago and then ran into some opposition at the site that they wanted to put it at. And then Mayor Carvalho, I know, has been diligently working with his folks, you know, with my support on getting a facility sited. And I think now that they've made a site selection, which is in the Ma'alo area near Honama'ulu, they are proceeding with some feasibility and operational kind of studies and analyses that will tell us what that facility would look like, you know, who would be serviced by it, how would they be serviced by it. And it is an incredibly frustratingly slow process as we continue to deal with folks on a daily basis who would benefit from the services of that facility. But I do believe that we will have one here on the island, and I am certainly, you know, going to do everything I can to help make sure that happens.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's incredibly lame that that doesn't exist by now. It's just a process, but my God, we really are in need of that. It needs to, you know, I don't know.
Thank you, caller. You're breaking up. Thank you.
Sorry. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Yeah, we definitely need one. I know it's been an issue of fiscal sustainability and survivability for facilities that have been here in the past and run into problems. So I'm hoping we can get those ironed out.
So we have one last quick call, and then I got a few announcements, and then you're going to have your last words, and we'll hear the county council report, and it'll be Jazz with John. Aloha, you're on the air.
You know, money is our greatest addiction. It buys mercenary armies. It gives birth to drug cartels. It creates huge disparity between the rich and poor. And drug addicts is a medical issue. It's not a judicial one. And I feel sorry for kids that get hooked on drugs, but it has so much to do with their parents. Their parents. You know, and they shouldn't just be haphazardly thrown in jail. And I'm more offended at millionaires that keep coming here and, like, develop Hanalei rich than someone who's strung out on opiates. You know, I mean, they put up private property signs on beaches so Hawaiians can't walk on their sacred ground. That upsets me a lot more than the drug problems in Hawaii.
Okay.
Because that ends up being a personal issue.
Thank you, caller. Thank you. Cy, people want to know how they can get a hold of you. You want to give your email address? What do you want?
You can call me.
Okay, what's your
My
phone number?
My number is 808-346-7384.
346?
7384.
7384. Okay, thank you so much. Couple quick announcements. Many really good things going on this weekend. One I'm very close to is the seed exchange, seed and plant exchange, this Saturday, 12 to 5 at Waipa. The Earth Day Rising event is happening Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at Waipa. Many, many great workshops there. The Irons Brothers contest is happening this weekend. KCC is having their Earth Day event on Monday. Next Tuesday, Earth Day at KCC is going to have a panel discussion on bioremediation of our soil with a film afterwards. I am actually the moderator of that, and it's going to be on this radio program. Then I want to just give a big yay that the bill for experimental hemp, it passed unanimously in the House and the Senate. So it just goes on to the governor to approve or not approve, and that's going to be really good for bioremediation. It's focused on bioremediation. How do we get our soils clean? I want to also announce that Judge Barry Curran, he granted the Center for Food Safety and Earth Justice intervener status on the Ordinance 960 lawsuit. That's something that we've been following quite a bit as a show. So coming up very soon, Jazz with John. Justin, which one of you guys wants the last word? Okay, Cy wants the last word.
We'll give Cy the last word.
Okay, you get like a minute and a half. You get a minute and a half, and then we're going to hear the county council report. And I want to see us really work hard to whatever we can to solve this situation.
Yeah, absolutely, and it is going to take all of us working together. Additional event that is happening this weekend on Saturday at Kapaa Beach Park is the MS Walk in the afternoon. That's where I'm going to be down there supporting some folks that I work with who are wonderful people. And, you know, also just want to say thank you to Felicia for inviting me to come up and be on the program again. It's been a while, so it's good to come up and check in. Thanks to Cy for coming and being here and having an awesome and what I think was a pretty productive conversation, and for all the folks that called in, because, you know, to tackle this problem is going to take a community response. You know, to address the issues that we discussed in the first half of the show, the Hawaiian rights issues associated with the criminal justice system is going to take a community response and a community conversation. And, you know, I know my role in that as a person who's not Hawaiian is mostly to sit back and listen to the folks who are affected by it. So happy to participate in that and just happy to do everything I can to serve and be part of the solution. So thanks a lot. Mahalo nui and aloha.
Thank you for being here. Cy?
So my last thing, I wanted to just share this little message with from one of the kupunas, Kupuna Maya. And I think I've said enough, but I think I was preparing for the conversation today, and I thought I'd go listen to some Maya Angelou. So I just wanted to share this little recording I got.
So thank you for sharing that. We're kind of running down on time there. That's great. It's a little hard to hear it, but I appreciate it.
Yeah, if you get a chance to listen to that, it's a great, great, just a great talk with Maya Angelou, and it's called I Am Human.
So post it on my Facebook wall. And next time we can put it through the computer, and so it will come right out through the machine.
So thank you, Justin, for being here, and Felicia again for letting me come in and engage.
Well, thank you both. This is an important discussion, and we have to make our community strong and whole. So I appreciate you both. This has been Kauai Soapbox on the station that loves you, KKCR. So after the county council report, we have Jeff.